So welcome back. Again, I'll begin with the apology for last week. I didn't have my computer and I was traveling, so I know I had a rough start. But so today's share, today's source sheet, we'll cover last week as well. And I'll begin with a quick review and then we'll get to work. So let me share my source sheet, share screen. I'll put it one more time in the chat. Okay, and I'll share my screen now and it'll be up on the website later. Here we are. Okay, so the title of our unit, probably like five or six classes, Converts or Strangers, Who's the Torah Care About? Or basically, our discussion is who is the stranger in Chumash? And I'll quickly review what we talked about last week. The strangers often, numerous times in Chumash. The other title for the whole series is The Centrality of the Stranger. In Sefer Bereshit, or the centrality of the stranger in the Torah, and especially in Chumash, in Tanakh not as much, but definitely in Chumash. In today's class we'll focus on Sefer Bereshit. So if you go to a concordancia or you go to Al Torah website, and we know how many times the word ger is mentioned, so it's twice in Sefer Bereshit, which will be our specific topic today after we do our review. 12 times in Sefer Shemot, 21 times in Vayikra, 11 in Bamidbar, 22 in Dvarim. If we have time, we'll see the ones in Tanakh. Tanakh, it's not too often, mostly in Yechezkel, a couple times in Tehillim, but primarily way out of proportion in Chumash. So the question is, why is the word ger, or why is the topic of ger so central to Chumash? And last week we discussed the big question, whether a ger in Chumash, is he Jew or Gentile? Now, I tried to show you last week that sometimes he has to be Jewish, sometimes he has to be non-Jewish. And every academic person I've asked, someone visiting for Shabbat who's a professor at Hebrew U, and I've asked people in the Bible department in Bar-Ilan, the consensus in academia is that a stranger is basically never Jewish, and they even doubt whether there's a whole topic of conversion. The whole concept of conversion only began Second Temple period. We've seen the Septuagint and Second Temple literature, but the idea of conversion is very common in Bayit Sheni, but they really doubt how serious it is or how possible it was in biblical times. So the goal of this series is not simply to argue with it. I just want to show you, I think, in Pshat, when you read a careful reading of Chumash and examine all the times the ger is mentioned, I'm going to try to suggest a way we can identify when a ger is Jewish or when he's not Jewish. And we began last week with examples of how many different ways a ger is mentioned in Chumash. So we have a ger should be Sharecha, we began with the Ten Commandments, which will be a shir later on. Who is that stranger who has to keep Shabbat in the Ten Commandments? Is he Jewish or not Jewish? The famous commandment to love the stranger, because God loves the stranger. Again, with the nimuk, with the reason, because you were strangers in Egypt, which implies that he's not Jewish, because we were not Egyptians, and we were strangers in Egypt, even though many halachic commentators claim that the mitzvah to say is only on a convert. Again, if we have time, we'll discuss that later on, not this week, when we get to Sefer Devarim. We have a ger who's in your land, ger shebaretzecha. We have, like in Bikurim, you have to be happy with the Levi and the ger. We'll talk about that in Devarim, my dafka, the Levi and the ger, where's the orphan and the widow. Many times you have, like, being happy on the holidays, you have to make everyone happy, including the stranger, the orphan and widow. Many times you have this phrase, the same law applies to the ezrach and the ger, who's living with you. See, that's by Korban Pesach, we'll see soon. Then we have all these laws where a ger has obligations. So we have a ger shebetocham. And again, I just brought some examples, but there's lots of different ways that the ger is mentioned in Chumash. We'll do those much more in detail later in the series. So in our share last week, I tried to prove to you that sometimes he has to be Jewish and sometimes he can't be Jewish. So the proof that the ger sometimes is not Jewish, beyond a shadow of a doubt, is when it says you don't eat a nevelah, you can't have a non-kosher animal or a kosher animal that was shechted not properly, it wasn't ritually slaughtered. Instead, you give it to the ger asher bisharecha, the ger in your gate, give it to him or gift it to him and let him eat it. Or you can sell it to a foreigner. Why? Because you're an Am Kadosh. which means he's not an Am Kadosh. No, it's clear that this stranger has to be someone not Jewish. Now, does that teach me that every time it says a ger should be sharecha, he's not Jewish? It could be. Does it mean every ger is not Jewish? That would be difficult to say, as we'll see. But definitely in Sefer Dvarim, in this section, it has to be talking about a stranger who did not convert, who's living among us. Now, earlier in Sefer Vayikra, we were told, should anyone from Israel or a ger who's guarding with us, and last week I tried to prove to you, a ger gar betocham or betochachem, that's a giveaway sign. It's talking about a convert. That's a stranger who did convert. He what do you call it? He is obligated in Kisui Adam and in he can't eat blood and basically has to keep kosher, basically. And should he eat an Avela, or anyone who eats an Avela, be a citizen or a stranger, we'll see this stranger has to be someone who converted. He becomes Tameh, he becomes ritually unclean and has to cleanse himself. And it's very widely accepted in Chumash that the whole concept of Tahor and Tameh only relates to Am Kadosh, and we can prove that later when we get to Sefer Vayikra. Now, the main thing we talked about last week is I made a distinction. We went through the 67 times. We didn't do it, but I shared that I went through it. And we check all the times that Gareth mentioned, and we have to distinguish between cases or instances when a Gareth mentioned where we are obligated to care for the stranger. It relates to our obligation to our care for the stranger, which is the majority of the time. And there are certain instances when the ger is obligated to keep a law. We brought examples of Yom Kippur, we brought a Parah Adumah, Shechut Echutz, shechting an animal outside the temple, or bringing a korban outside the temple. We had Arayot, illicit incest and things like that, and forbidden relationships. We'll see many more of them. In fact, we're going to go over them very soon. But there's many instances where a ger is specifically mentioned with an obligation of not only the ger himself. I think we rarely find a time where there's an obligation only for the ger. But when there's an obligation for the Jewish people, sometimes it mentions the ger as well. We're going to go over them very soon. What's that mean? That means the Torah is obligating a ger to keep a law. And the question is, if he's not Jewish, if he didn't convert, how can the Torah obligate someone who's not part of our people? So a very classic approach, which again we'll see in later Shiurim, is that when we see this primarily in the book of Vayikra and in the book of Bamidbar, we can see a lot of commentators are going to claim that even though he's not Jewish, because he's living among us, he has certain obligations because he's living among us. If we keep Shabbos, he just keeps Shabbos and things like that. Again, we'll discuss those opinions. But on the other hand, it makes more sense, at least to me, that if the Torah obligates a ger, it has to be, the Torah can only obligate people who are part of the covenant. Now, what we're going to show you today is almost every time that there's an obligation of the stranger, when it's a prohibition of something he can't do, the punishment is always going to be karet. He's cut off from his people. And if the punishment is karet and he's cut off from his nation, that implies he's a member of the nation. In contrast, when we have our obligation to the stranger, then it can be designated as only a non-Jewish stranger, but includes a non-Jewish stranger. I had that question from a lot of people after this year, is that I'm not saying every time it says a stranger of our obligation to a stranger that he's only a non-Jew, but it includes a non-Jew. You know, being kind to the stranger, of course, one who converted, but even one who didn't convert. And then we brought the example, sometimes it must be non-Jew when it's talking about eating an Avela. Now, if you go through the 67 times the ger is mentioned, so here are the examples. This we talked about in general. I want to show you now more in detail this week before we get to Sefer Bereshit. These are the phrases that we find when he's obligated. So every time it says keger keezrach, I'm sorry for not writing that in Hebrew, but every time, many times in Chumash, actually not that many times, there's four over here. Every time when it says we put the ger, the stranger, and the ezrach together. The example is in Korban Pesach and Chametz in chapter 12 in Shmot, and in cursing Hashem in chapter 15 in Bamidbar, and the idea of Megadef. We'll do that when we study Sefer Bamidbar. And whenever we have Ger and Ezrach together, we're going to go through it. We'll try to prove that every time we get there. That's talking about a Ger who has converted. Why? What's the difference between an Ezrach and a Ger? What I want to claim is that an Ezrach is someone who owns land and owns the land and it comes back to him every Yovel, which means an Ezrach can only be a member of the 12 tribes because the original division of the 12 tribes was done after Yeshua conquered the land. Anyone who was a member of one of the 12 tribes in the original conquest of the land has a right to land. If he sells the land, it comes back to him in the Shemitah year. Therefore, he has financial security almost forever. In that sense, he's always an Ezrach because he has, again, not that he owns land right now, but he owns land when the Yovel cycle restarts. As opposed to a Ger can never officially become a member of a tribe. He can convert, but he's always a Ger. He's always a stranger, even though he's converted. And therefore, when you have Ger and Ezrach together, we'll see the entire nation of Israel, Kol Adat Yisrael, Kager Ke Ezrach. The people of Israel include members of the tribes, as well as strangers who have converted. And they become the people of Israel. So whenever the word Ger is with Ezrach, it's usually someone who's converted. And we'll prove that again from Korban Pesach and from Chametz. Now, then we have the obligations of the Ger, where it's Chayv Karet, and Vayikra, especially. We're on Yom Kippur. We saw the Pasuk in chapter 16. A Ger is obligated to do Inui, which we interpret as fasting, and not doing any work on Yom Kippur. He's not allowed to bring a Korban outside the temple. If he does, he's Chayv Karet. He's not allowed to eat blood. If he does, he's Chayv Karet. Karet means being cut off from his people. He becomes Tamei Fitz in the Vela. If he does one of the prohibitions of the Arayot, of the forbidden relationships in marriage, he's Chayv Karet. So it mentions him by Nesachim, that we'll do in Sefer Bamidbar, but that's not an obligation to bring. That's not a prohibition. So he's not Chayv Karet, but he also has to bring flour and wine, just like everyone else when he brings a Korban. So those cases, Ger Asher B'tochachem, or Ger Asher Itchem, those seem to be a phrase that means it's someone who's converted, which makes sense because he's in your midst already. And Ger B'tocham is the same idea, and that's the Korban Shkaga that he has to bring. Or also, if the Beit Din made a mistake called Par HaElam Dabar Shot Zibur, remember the Pasek V'nistach L'cho Adab B'nei Yisrael V'legar Ger B'tocham, if he needs kapara or slicha for sin of the Beit Din, it only makes sense that he's part of the nation. Par Adum we talked about, if he becomes tamei, he needs to be sprinkled upon if he touches the dead body. As the law of Molech, he's chayv karet, and then if he brings a korban, it can be a balmum. All these cases, when we see them in our study of each of those books in the next shiurim, we're going to see almost whenever there's a prohibition, his punishment is karet, and we explained last week, if he's cut off from his people, that means he's a member of the people. And what I suggested, whenever there's a prohibition where the punishment is karet, almost every single time that happens, we include the Ger, and that's to be inclusive of the Ger to tell us, even though we might think he's not part of a nation, that specifically is part of the nation. Almost exactly the opposite of what the people say in academia, that he can never become Jewish. The exact opposite. Chumash is emphasizing that he is part of the nation once he converts, and therefore he can be cut off from his people, which means he's part of his people. So we talked about the prohibitions of Karet, and then where do we find our obligation to the Ger? As I mentioned, there are three key sections in Chumash that talk about day-to-day life as a Jew. Right after the Ten Commandments, in the first three chapters of afterwards, in Parshat Mishpatim, chapters 21 through 23, we'll see when we next week share, maybe we'll talk about it briefly this week, the Ger is very central to that section. Not so much in quantity, how many times it's mentioned, but where it's mentioned and how it becomes an envelope to an entire section. It's key at the conclusion of chapter 19 in Vayikra, Kedoshim to you, and it's replete all through the main speech of Sefer Dvarim. We have it numerous times, and the main speech of Dvarim, which are the main laws that come with the Ten Commandments, the Moshe reviews in Sefer Dvarim, So in all those cases, in these three sections, which is day-to-day Jewish life, we find it's not the obligation of the stranger, but rather our obligation to the stranger. Sometimes it's ger shebi sharecha, sometimes it's plain ger, sometimes ger shebi kebecha, but never ger shebi tochachem. But that's what we're going to find in Vayikra and certain parts of Bamidbar. But in these sections, it's always going to be either a plain ger, plain stranger by itself, or a ger in your midst, in your gates. And that'll include even a ger who's not Jewish, and we have to prove that when we study. So that was the review we did last week, pretty much. And today we're going to get to Sefer Bereshit. Let me just stop here. Any questions till now? Let's check the chat real fast. Let's see. Okay. And what about the Midianites who were related to Yitro and converted? Did they own land? So Shelley, where do we find about Midian, other than Yitro, which I'm not sure if he converted, where do we have Midianites converting?
Isn't there the idea that some of them, or maybe it's later on in Tanakh when we've got Midianites living among us, isn't Yael one of them or something like that, that they got some, that, or is it a Medrash?
In Shoftim, back in Chumash, when Moshe offers Chovav, Moshe, to come with him, he actually gets a piece of the land. He gets a nachla among them, but that's part of the original nachla. That's it. That's a special case that has to do with Chovav, and he's mentioned. But Yael herself, if I'm not mistaken, is not Jewish. Am I right? In the story of Yael,
she's
Shoftim.
But she is a Midianite, isn't she?
She's a Midianite. I don't think she's Jewish. I don't think she ever became a stranger. She never became a convert. I don't think. Now, there's a whole issue whether there's a need for a female to convert. Can a Jew marry? In Chumash, I'm pretty sure, a Jew cannot marry one of the members of the Seven Nations or an idol worshiper. But if a Jew marries a non-Jew, if a male Jew from one of the tribes marries a non-Jew, I'm pretty sure it becomes his wife and she becomes part of the people through marriage. So do you need a conversion process? That's an interesting question. That doesn't come up that often in Chumash. You have something with Ruth, but that question is Ruth. What makes Ruth Jewish? The fact that Boaz marries her, or does she have to go through a conversion process? That's a discussion for, if we get to, maybe we'll talk about strangers later in Tanakh after Chumash.
I will type in a question while you have to take questions. So, can I go back to the case where you say the guy is must be Jewish because he's obligated Shabbat? My question is, if he's Jewish, why wouldn't you assume automatically that he is obligated in Shabbat? And why would you have to mention the guy in the first place?
Okay, perfect. So if I understand your question, which we're going to talk about many times, is that if a guy is Jewish and he's converted, then why mention him? Just mention one time a convert is obligated in everything. So if all these obligations and prohibitions, we include the ger, and if he's Jewish, just say everyone's obligated. Why this friendship between Ezrach and ger? So each time we find that, and we'll go through each one of them when we go book by book, we have to see, I'll give for example. It could be that a stranger might not be obligated to keep chametz or eat matzah or keep chametz or bring Karban Pesach because he didn't leave Egypt. So it could be other laws he's obligated, but someone might think because he was not redeemed from Egypt, he's not obligated with the laws of Chametz and Matzah. Therefore, Torah tells us, no, he's obligated in Chametz. So I can go each case when we find an obligation of the ger. I can think maybe there's a Havamina, whatever, how you translate in English. I might think that he wouldn't be obligated because of his status, and then the Torah tells you he's obligated anyhow. But then if I can find a reason like that, then your question becomes stronger. Then if he's Jewish, then why mention, just say everybody, why mention the ger? And that's what I tried to explain last week, is that you're right. If he's Jewish, of course he's obligated. But every time there's a prohibition where the punishment is karet, you're being cut off karet from his people, Chumash intentionally mentions him to teach you that he's part of your nation.
I think that there's an argument in my not be a good argument, but I can make an argument that he's not Jewish. And my argument would be that the Torah trying to tell us that you can't get a non-Jew to do melacha.
But when it comes to Shabbos, we'll see. When it comes to the Ten Commandments, that's a big argument. Is it Ger mentioned because he can't work for you? So the law of Shabbos is really interesting, and we have to see. It's in Devarim, also in Shmot, and we're going to try and solve it in Pshat, whether it's talking about a Jewish stranger or a non-Jewish stranger, whether it's a convert or not. No, why we include the Ger. Our conclusion will be that probably he's not Jewish, but he can't work for you. But again, we have to do it carefully. But in general, we're going to do each of these cases by themselves. And now, again, there's another approach that even though he's not Jewish, he's obligated because he's part of our society. Then we have to explain why specifically these laws. It was why Dafki Yom Kippur and not other laws or not other holidays. One more question, Ruth. Go ahead.
Yes, please. Just clarify. You are making a distinction between Bitocham and Bisharecha.
Not only that, I'm going to say Bitocham, Bitochechem, or Yitchem, or B'Yisrael, we'll see. Okay. Those are all cases where he's a convert, because that's what it means. We now have Ger Sher Bisharecha in your gates, or B'Kirbechem in your midst, or Stam Ger. Those are always cases where it's our obligation to him. Okay. And therefore, most likely, it includes even a non-Jewish stranger.
Okay.
Not exclusively someone non-Jewish, but including someone non-Jewish, didn't convert. There'll be a couple cases like Hakel and by Brit Nitzavim that we have to look with a microscope and scrutinize. We'll spend time on this when we get to Sefer Devarim. We'll probably need two or three classes on Devarim because there's a lot of cases there, a lot of borderline ones. But for sure, when you look at the three law units, again, the three chapters of Parshat Mishpatim, Kedoshim to you, and the laws in Devarim, in the main speech, it's pretty easy to prove we're talking about, he's not necessarily Jewish. Any stranger, as long as he's not detrimental to society. And my approach will be that I don't think the Torah can command, that the Torah is for the people who are part of a covenant, and any obligation or prohibition or anything you have to do can only be focused on the Torah can only obligate members of the covenant. Yeah, we have to see. Okay, let me close up the chat and we'll get back. Now we finally get to today's topic, Sefer Bereshit. Now, there are two times the Ger is mentioned in Sefer Bereshit. When Avram wants to build buy a burial plot in Hebron, Parshat Chayei Sarah, and we'll have that in 2 weeks. And the big case is in Brit Ben Haftarim. In the covenant of the parts, and that's going to be critical. So again, it doesn't happen, come up too much, but we're going to see now in the very first covenant that God makes with Avram Avinu, and the covenant that's made with God's name, Yud Kei Vav Kei, which leads to the whole story of our becoming a nation in someone else's land, and our enslavement in Egypt, and our exodus from Egypt, and our redemption, which is such a central theme in the Torah. There's so many holidays, which is definitely set Mitzrayim, and so many mitzvot that are need to remember the Exodus. The centrality of the stranger in that covenant already indicates there's something very basic going on. So let's share my screen again. We'll go back to our source sheet and we're going to follow this now. Okay. So again, Sefer Bereshit, it's only the words mentioned twice. Avram, the people of Hebron, and the stranger in Brit Ben Haftarim. I should really mention that that's in chapter 15, is Brit Ben Haftarim. It's interesting, in chapter 16, which we read on Shabbat, what happens, Hagar, her name, probably an Egyptian name, but it's really interesting that Her name in Hebrew means the stranger. And Caesar, she's from Mitzrit. And we'll see later on, she is sort of afflicted, or totally have the word Inui. There's so many parallels between Brit Ben Ptarim and the story of Sarah and Hagar and Abraham that they're next door neighbors in Chumash. They're probably connected. But again, that's not the word ger, but the concept of ger and how we treat them for sure comes up in that story. So first, I want to point out the covenantal nature of it, where God's going to tell Avram in Brit Ben Ptarim, we'll get to the details in a minute, you should surely know, ki ger yezar chaber solahem. That's the first time ger is mentioned in Chumash, if I'm not mistaken. And our offspring, God tells Avram, your offspring are going to be afflicted and enslaved for a period over 400 years, but I'm going to punish their oppressor. You'll leave with great wealth. And then that day, where God sort of promised that to Avram Avinu, predicted it, that day came hand in hand with the covenant that God makes with Avram about promising the land. So, a couple things. Number one, this is a covenant between God and his people that starts at the seed level with Avram Avinu, and is so central to our religion and to the whole book of Shemot, Exodus, so many laws. More important is that Brit Ben Ptarim is the first time we find a dialogue, not just a commandment, but a dialogue between God and Avraham Avinu. Now, dialogues are very rare in Chumash, where God actually has a dialogue, a conversation with man. The first one with Adam and Cain, with Adam and Adam Harishon and God when he sinned, and with Cain when he sinned. But God's conversations with Adam Harishon and with Cain are in the context of man sinning and God reacting to his sin, and they become sort of a paradigm and teaching us that God's expectations for man, there's a concept of punishment, and man's responsible for his behavior, either for disobeying God, Ben Adam Lamakom in Gan Eden, or Ben Adam Lachaveiro, with the story of Cain and Heva. But those are the only two dialogues between God and man before Avram Avinu, but those are dialogues that relate to sin and punishment. The first time we have an actual dialogue of conversation that's not relating to punishment or sin, but relating to a relationship, is between God and Avram Avinu. It happens twice in Sefer Bereshit with Avram Avinu, never with Yitzhak, Yaakov, or any of the tribes. There's never a dialogue like you have with Abraham. And the very first one is Brit Ben Ptarim, which includes the concept of a ger. The second one is the story of Sdom, which is also about a type of what we expected in our behavior. So just before we get to the story, the very fact that this is the first and primary conversation between God and man in Sefer Bereshit in the context of a covenant. And it's forecasting not only the future of the Jewish people, but the idea that God wants a nation, but to become God's nation, there's a need to go through this basic training stage of suffering in someone else's land. If we have to experience that suffering as part of our initial stage of becoming a nation, that means that idea of being a stranger in someone else's land has to be important. We even mentioned last week, I think, that Moshe Rabbeinu himself sees himself as a stranger everywhere he goes. In Midian, he's a stranger. In Egypt, he's a stranger. To the people, he's a stranger. And therefore, when he names his first son, Gershon, ki Amar ki Ger Ha'iti, we mentioned, that you really see a person's, like what's on a person's mind, you can see in the way he names his children. So now I'm going to go back and review Brit Ben Ptarim. I'm going to share one other I can share with you later on. The conversations in Bereshit are between God and Cain, between man and God with Ayeka. That was in chapter 3 in Sefer Bereshit. Between God and Cain, there's a conversation. There's Brit Ben Ptarim, conversation we'll see soon. And regarding stone, there's a big conversation between God and Avraham Avinu. Those are the main times. But now in Brit Ben Ptarim, there are two conversations. I'm going to show you the English in a minute, but in Hebrew, the first conversation after the war of the four kings and five kings, the first conversation, the topic is about having children, Zera, Avram having offspring. He doesn't have and he's worried about it. And God says, don't worry, you will have. And Avram believes. The second conversation is about the land, where God tells Avram, I took you out of Ur Kasdim, I brought you from Mesopotamia to conquer and inherit this land, to possess the land. And Avram wants to know how and when it's going to happen. And then in that context, we have the promise of how we become a nation, which we're going to read about now. So anyway, that's Brit Ben Ptarim. That's a associate that highlights the word Yerusha. That's not our topic for today. Our topic for today is why this idea of Kigeria Zaracha, why they need to go through slavery and be a stranger in someone else's land. So let's go back to our source sheet and we'll study Sefer Bereshit, chapter 15. Just a quick review. Okay, after the events, most likely, of the War of the Four Kings and Five Kings, what does God tell Avram? And it gets in a vision, in a prophetic vision. He tells Avram, don't worry, I'm going to protect you. And you have great schar. And again, that's a great way to start. That's God talking to Avram Avinu that sort of is expecting a response. When someone tells you, don't worry, I'll protect you, it only makes sense the person will respond. Now, Avram is assuming, and this is important for understanding what's happening, it's only logical for Avram to think when God says, don't worry, I'll protect you, Avram is assuming that God says, don't worry, one day you have children. And that's Avram's response. Because he says, if you're promising me schar, because Avram's responding to, you have great schar, Avram's saying, what can you give me? I have no one to give anything you give me. I have no one to give it to other than Eliezer, head of my household. Because you haven't given me any children. Okay? And God tells him, don't worry. Someone from your offspring will inherit you. He takes him out. He looks at the stars. Says, that's how many kids you'll have. That's what your children at least will be like. And God, what do you call it? He believed God's promise. And who considered who? It was righteous. Again, that's an argument among the commentators. Who's considering this righteousness? Avram considered God's promise righteous, or did God consider Avram's belief righteousness? That's the topic for Sefer Bereshit, for study. Our topic is in the second half. That's the first conversation. In the second conversation, God's going to tell Avram as follows. And I think that this is what the first conversation is almost parenthetical, because God's opening statement, don't worry, Avraham, doesn't really relate to the promise of children, because that's not what God was saying. God's saying, don't worry about that. That'll be. What do you need to worry about and what do you need protection from? Because you're about to go into 400 years of exile and suffering. And don't worry, even though you're going into that exile, even though you have this startup stage of suffering and enslavement, don't worry, I'll protect you through it and get you out of it. And at the end, you'll have great schar. What I'm saying is that this opening line, Avram thinks it's about children, and God says, no, it's not about children. And he says, you promised them children. When I said, don't worry, I'm referring to the second conversation, which begins in Pasuk Zayin, where God tells Avram, the reason I took you out of Mesopotamia was to come to this land and conquer it and possess it. And Avram wants to know, we'll see in a minute, he's not doubting God because he believes in God. He wants to know how or when he's going to possess it, because he just conquered it, but the War of the Four Kings and Five Kings had to give it away. He had no one to give it to. He had no children. Now, before God gives the answer to Baba Ma'ida, they have this little ceremony where they cut animals in half, and that was in ancient times. That's the way you made treaties. You took animals, you cut them apart. We see that in Yirmiyahu chapter 34. Again, that's a topic for when we study Brit Ben Avtarim in detail in Sefer Bereshit. But for our shiur today, the answer to Avram's question, this should be quite obvious. When Avram asked the question, "Bema eda ki irashena," so the answer is Yodo teda. Need a better color for that thing. Let's make it red. It should be better. That's much better. Okay. When Avram asked, "Bema eda ki irashena," so the answer to "Bema eda" seems to be Yodo teda. That would be the logical answer. And then the question is, before God gives them the answer, we make this little ceremony, which will be related to the covenant that will be at the end of the story. So based on God's answer, we can really understand the question, because the question is unclear what Avram's asking about. But in God's answer, what does he tell him? Let me clear the drawing and come back to the mouse. What does God tell Avram? What should you know? That your offspring that I just promised you, that'll be like the stars in the sky, they're going to be strangers in someone else's land. They're going to be enslaved and oppressed. Okay, and this will happen over a time period of 400 years. Now, is it 400 years of oppression or 400 years until you possess the land? So Chazal understand, and that's pshat, that it's not 400 years of oppression. It's 400 years from today, or from the time you have children, until you possess the land. During those 400 years, there'll be a time period within those 400 years of your of slavery and oppression. But at the end of your oppression, God's going to punish your oppressor, and you'll leave with great wealth at the end. And that's the story of the Exodus and leaving Egypt. But he says, won't happen in your lifetime. And but when they come back, it'll be four generations later. Again, all the problems of who are the four generations, what do we come from, and how to count to 400 years is not important for today's class. And again, another reason why you can't have it right away, it needs to take so much time, is because I can't give you the land until the Amorites deserve to be thrown out. And that's, again, that's a topic for Sefer Vayikra. Now, when it's over, on that day, we're told that God made a covenant with Avram promising the land. And therefore, the promise of conquering the land, inheriting the land, and becoming a nation, for some reason, in this first dialogue between God and Avram Avinu, in this first covenant, it's necessary for Avram to go into slavery and be redeemed to become that nation. Now, there's one direction in commentators, the Maharal talks about it in the Berurat Hashem, where because this is told to Avram Avinu in chapter 15 and not in chapter 12, this is in the middle of Lech Lecha, not the beginning of Lech Lecha, some commentators say that this must be a punishment for something Avram did wrong. Had Avram just been perfect, he would have come to Israel and inherited the land, and there would never have been a need to go down to Egypt or any type of exile. But because he did something wrong, that's why this is happening. I'll just give the three classic answers. I'm sure we're familiar with them. The famous one is because Avram, you know, what happened between chapter 12 and chapter 15? Well, in chapter 12, there was a famine and Avram went down to Egypt. So if you hold, like I call it the Zionist answer, if you hold that going down to Egypt during a famine is wrong, you have to have faith in God and stay in Israel, no matter how bad things are, then Avram is being punished for his lack of faith. And because he went down to Egypt, his children will go down to Egypt. But Avram came back with great wealth from Egypt. So we came back with great wealth. So it's almost like foreshadowing Jewish history. I just have trouble with that, because if Avram sinned, then how come his children get punished, not Avram himself? And it seems like in halacha, it makes sense that if he went down, God didn't tell him don't go down. When Yitzhak wanted to go down, God told him not to, because it was a different type of, it wasn't such a bad famine. But I can't prove from here that you shouldn't leave Israel in times of trouble. Maybe you have to survive. Again, that's a hashkafa argument. But it's hard to say that this is only because of Avram went down to Egypt because it was a famine. That's what people do when you have to survive. Now, the other approach, which is they call the Yeshiva approach, because of the War of the Four Kings and Five Kings, during that war, he took his Hanichim, remember, Verchet Hanichav, 318 Yeshiva students who were sitting and learning. The fact you took them to war, so that's your punishment, which is classic Midrash, about, you know, more important to learn Torah than serve in the army. But that can't be, I don't think that's simple pshat for what's happening. The best one is because of this question. Now, Avram just accepted, it would have been fine, but God just promised them the land because Avram asked questions. So how do I know when you doubt God? And he asked questions, therefore that you're being punished. And therefore I learned from there, when the Rebbe tells you something, don't ask specific questions. And look what happened when Avram started asking questions he shouldn't be asking. Again, those are all midrashim, which are deal with a lot of hashkafa. But I'll try to explain why it can't be pshat. It can't be pshat because when you get to the altar, and that's, I want to point out, because all the law sections in Chumash later on, use our suffering in Egypt as a motivator for our behavior. It seems like this was necessary to become God's nation. And that was the key point I tried to explain last week as well, is that the theme of being sensitive to the stranger is so central to the law sections of Chumash, and our need to be sensitized and to remember that we were slaves in Egypt, and therefore don't mistreat strangers in your land, and don't mistreat your workers, and don't afflict slaves and things like that who's ever working for you. It's remembering how you were mistreated and redeeming that experience and making you a better person and keeping that on your mind every day of your life and going crazy about it once a year. It's so central to our Judaism, it makes more sense that this whole experience of becoming a nation in someone else's land has to be a collective experience of the nation that's necessary to become God's nation. It becomes part of our collective DNA and part of our, like, eternal memory. And because it comes up, because it's referred to so many times later in Chumash, as we'll see, it makes more sense to me that God wants this to happen. Now, you can argue how bad the oppression had to be. We'll see that maybe in Sefer Shemot. It could be that it didn't have to be so harsh on the people. Maybe we were partially blamed because we sold Yosef, because maybe we took advantage of our higher position in Egypt when we got protexia during the famine, and we kept our land and everyone else lost their land, or because of what Yosef did, buying up all the land from Pharaoh. So there's lots of different reasons that it could be that our oppression in Egypt was our fault as well, not just something that had to happen, but we made it worse. Again, that's a big argument among commentators about how bad our suffering in Egypt had to be. But there's no doubt that when we thank God for taking us out of Egypt, we also have to thank God for putting sin to take us out. And that was one of the things at the Seder. Now, so again, that's this covenant that we find in Sefer Bereshit. Now, I want to prove my point about all the mitzvot and chumash that relate to this experience. And hence, in my opinion, Brit Ben Abtarim is not a punishment for something Avraham Avinu did wrong, but rather something central, necessary experience to become God's nation. I compare it to basic training in the army or going through residency if you're a doctor or any type of training before becoming a professional. Now, one of the proofs for that is going to be in those sections of laws that are going to follow in Chumash. So we'll see examples in Sefer Shemot. In Parshat Mishpatim, we have laws that it's primarily laws that deal with man and his fellow man, to follow the Ten Commandments. Remember, we'll go back over it later when we do Sefer Shemot, but there's two primary sections of law in Parshat Mishpatim between man and his fellow man. There's what's called Nizikin, damages, which is written in case, should this happen, here's a Pesach Beitin. It's case law. And then there's a whole section of absolute law, things you have to do that deal with moral behavior. And that begins in chapter 22, verse 20. Again, we'll do this in detail when we do Sefer Shemot next week. It begins with, don't oppress a stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. Now, even if you weren't strangers, we wouldn't be allowed to do that. But you of all people shouldn't do that because you were strangers in Egypt. And don't mistreat an orphan and a widow. And then that's 22:20. That's followed by law after law after law of moral behavior. Not to be mean and not to be unkind, but and to be nice and return lost items and not to take bribes and to stay away from lying and things like that and being a good citizen. And it all ends with repeating V'gelo Techatz, don't oppress the stranger. And here's the key line. Batem yedatem nefesh ager, you know what it feels like to be a stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. That line, in my opinion, especially this one, you know what it feels like to be a stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. That means to appreciate the laws and safety that we received right with the Ten Commandments on the same day with the Ten Commandments of Parshat Mishpatim. Our experience of slavery in Egypt is key for appreciating the laws that we get in Sefer and Parshat Mishpatim. So if we didn't go through that slavery in Egypt, we wouldn't appreciate the laws that we have in Parshat Mishpatim. And that goes back to explain why it was necessary in Brit Ben Abtarim to go through that suffering to become God's people. So that's one unit of mitzvot. And these become bookends. These two psukim, 22:20 and 23:9, we'll see next week, are bookends for a whole section of moral law that guide our behavior. The main law section in Sefer Vayikra is chapter 19, Kedoshim Tiyu. And what do we find there? First of all, in the first section, when you harvest your field, you know, leave over leket shichan peah, etc. Who did we leave them for? Don't take everything when you harvest the field. Leave over when you're harvesting. Leave it for the poor, the stranger. And that's a lot that's repeated later in Parshat Emor as well. That's in the first section. But at the very end of Parshat of Kedoshim Tiyu, and this is like the grand finale of chapter 19, even though it said earlier, "V'after l'recha kamocha," you have to love your neighbor like yourself or your friend like yourself. It said, "Should a stranger be living b'chagui t'chager b'artzachem in your land?" Again, not b'tochachem, but this has to be in simple reading, a stranger who's not Jewish, in your land, don't mistreat him because it's so easy to mistreat him. Okay? So don't wrong him. Instead, treat him like an Ezrach. Treat him like a citizen. Okay? And love him v'after lo kamocha. Then not only v'after l'recha kamocha, okay? Even love the stranger like one of your own. Why? And you, again, kigir meitem beretz Mitzrayim. Again, that phrase, because you are strangers in Egypt, means Chumash is building its law section on our experience of suffering, and goes back to, again, why there was a need to go through that suffering in the beginning. So that's the grand finality of Kedushim to you. And then it's all through the laws in Devarim, it's replete. But the best case is in Devarim chapter 10, when we're talking about how great God is and what God wants from you. People will see it more in detail inside. Hashem is the God of all gods. That makes it to Shemon Esrei. Doesn't take. And then we're describing God who does justice to the orphan and the widow. God who loves the stranger, giving him clothing. And then we're told it's our obligation to love the stranger because we are strangers in Egypt. So again, is that talking about this obligation of Avta Metager? Is it talking about only a Jewish convert or anyone stranger among our midst? Simple reading is, based on the words, if we were strangers in Egypt, we were outsiders, we weren't part of the Egyptian people, then it's talking about someone who's not a convert or including someone who's not a convert. How the people count mitzvot, how they explain this law being for converts or non, we'll see later when we get to Sefer Devarim. What's important for me, though, again, is that this repeating phrase, because you were strangers in Egypt, you were slaves in someone else's land. Remember you were a slave in Egypt. That's going to be later in chapter 24 in Devarim. When you're judging people, don't mistreat the judgment, again, of the stranger or the orphan. And don't mistreat the Almanah. Why? Remember, you were a slave in Egypt. Again, we have the memory of Egypt that shapes our behavior. We call it a transformative memory. And God took you out of there. And therefore, I'm commanding you all these laws about your behavior. And the same thing, not just in business, but also in farming. When you're harvesting your field, make sure to leave over in your field, pretend to forget. Leave it for the stranger or Lord from the widow, like in Megillat Rut, so that God should bless you. The same thing with your olive harvest, the same thing with your grape harvest. Leave it for the Ger Yotam and Amana. And remember, you were slaves in Egypt. And therefore, I'm commanding you to keep all these laws. So you can see that repeated phrase of remembering you were a slave in Egypt. We'll see it back in the Ten Commandments as well in Sefer Devarim. It means that's a transformative memory that shapes how you behave. It's not just thanking God that he saved you. It's remembering why he put you in to take you out, because that memory shapes how you behave day to day. And I'm just using all these, again, all these we'll see much more in detail when we learn the books, the stranger in each book. But I'm just trying to explain why Sefer Bereshit has that as its opening line. Now, the last example in Sefer Bereshit is when Avram wants to bury Sarah. So this would be good for next week's Parshat Shavuot, or in 2 weeks. Remember how Sarah lives 127 years and she dies in Hebron. And Avram needs to buy a burial place. What does he tell B'nai Chet? The people were sovereign then in that time. He says, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. What am I? I'm a stranger and he says sojourner. Someone tell me, what do you think is the difference between a ger and a toshav? Or are they two different things? Does Avram have double identity? What does he mean, I'm a stranger but a toshav? Anyone want to say something?
I live among you, but I'm not an equal citizen. I don't own land.
Yeah, in other words, I'm living among you. I'm a citizen. In other words, I'm living among you, but not one of you. Almost like a Jew in England or in America, where you're part of society from a civil point of view. You're living with everyone else, and you have your civil responsibilities, but you have a different covenantal community. Your covenantal community is different from your civil community. Therefore, you're living what they call an American Jew or Jewish American. You're living in a community, and you have civil obligations and rights in your community like everyone else living there. But your covenantal community is different. And therefore, on the one hand, I'm a stranger. I don't fit in. On the other hand, I'm living among you. And that's the reason why, on the one hand, I don't have anything on my own. But on the other hand, I should have a burial place because I need to bury my dead because I'm living here among you. On the other hand, I'm a stranger, therefore I don't own land. Now, that's why the opposite of a ger is an ezrach. The opposite of a ger is not a toshav. That's my point. If I'm looking for opposites, a ger is opposite to an ezrach. Ezrach is someone who has eternal land rights, like he's sovereign in the land. And that's why the ezrach has land that goes back to him every yovel. He has a permanent connection to land, where a ger doesn't own land forever. Whereas a toshav is someone living in the land. Now, a ger can be someone who's not living with us. He can be just, you know, a stranger coming through and not settling in one place, like a gypsy. He can be a nomadic person. Wouldn't be a ger, could be a ger, not a toshav. But a toshav is someone who's living among you on a regular basis. Then we'll see later on, a nochri is an outside visitor. He's not part of your society at all. He can be a businessman coming to visit or a tourist, but he's not part of your society. That'll be a nochri.
You can possibly say that a toshav is a resident and an ezrach is a citizen.
Okay, but again, what's the difference between a resident and a citizen?
Well, a citizen is a more permanent, you know, you can be a resident of a country without having citizenship in the country.
But you can be a permanent resident. So that's the question. Is a citizen, is that a covenantal community? So in our modern day democracies, a citizen has the right to vote, if I got it right. And non-citizens don't have the right to vote. In America, what's the difference between a permanent resident and a citizen?
The right to vote. If you don't take the oath of allegiance to the Constitution, you're a permanent resident, but you're not a citizen.
And what's the difference? You don't have to fight in the army?
But
the citizens have that residents don't have. Just the right to vote and run for office?
Social security.
I'm not sure. I'm asking in American law.
I think to make the difference into how your society will live, you do that by voting.
So that's classic democracy, yeah.
Right, and therefore one who's just residing in there has to go along with whatever the majority has decided.
Yeah, so in general...
If I may ask a question, you can't serve on a jury if you're not a citizen. There are certain corporations you can't be the head of, let's say those connected with defense. There are many, many restrictions on non-citizens, even in the United States.
There's another one that maybe... you cannot be expelled from your country.
Yeah, you have rights, but again, the main thing is you don't have I see that citizenship is part of a covenantal community that you share common goals, and you know, it's because I could be drafted and I could be, you know, I need to be loyal to my country. There's a type of loyalty behind being a citizen. That might be the type of ezrach also. But what I'm saying, I think toshav, I don't think toshav is opposite than a ger. You can be an ezrach who's a toshav as well. Someone, a permanent resident, someone living among us is a toshav, but he's not part of the covenantal community, therefore it makes him a ger. Now, we're going to see a ger can't be an ezrach, and an ezrach can't be a ger, but both of them can be toshavim. Now, the reason I'm pointing this out in Sefer Bereshit, there's many topics in Sefer Bereshit to set the stage for laws later in Chumash. Like we talked about Reach Tichoach once, maybe. In other words, there's many things that happen in Bereshit. Like the flood story sets the stage for Har Sinai with the 40 days and 40 nights and the covenant before and after. And again, so Yibu. It could be that the reason why Chumash tells us this encounter between Avram and B'nei Chet might relate later to the laws of Shemitah itself, which almost define what it means to be an Ezrach, because what's God say at the end? V'aretz lo timacher latzmitut, that you can't sell land forever. That was, the land belongs to God, and it resets itself every 50 years, but no one should have this ownership of land forever. Why? Because all the land belongs to God, and then this has to be related to Bereshit. What's God say? Ki gerim v'toshavim etamim adi. Words, even though we're living in the land, you know, the way we need to feel is because the land doesn't belong to us, despite what a lot of people are taught. The land belongs to God. That's the first Rashi and Chumash. God gives it to who's ever deserving. And we need to know the land, we have it on the condition that we keep its mitzvot and fulfill the goal of being Jewish. So God won't throw us out the minute we do something wrong, but he'll warn us if we continuously don't fulfill our goal as God's people, he might throw us out and send us into exile or rehab until we're ready to come back or until he gives us another try. So the idea that in our own land, even though we're sovereign and we own the land, once we conquer the land and we're able to parcelize it and give it out and we have our own ownership and we're sovereign, what the laws of Shemitah teach us in Sefer Vayikra, especially the law of Yovel, is that we need to remember that even though we're sovereign, we're really not sovereign. The land really, the sovereign is God. And in God's land, we're gerim v'toshavim, in contrast to God, in contrast to, in words, we need to know it's not, it doesn't belong to us. We have the land on loan on the condition we keep God's mitzvot. So the land becomes a vehicle to fulfill our goal as God's nation, but we don't own it. God wants us to feel that we're gerim v'toshavim, meaning the way Avram feels with Bnei Chet is why we need to feel with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the land. Now, not that we're strangers on our land, we're living in the land, but as far as feeling we can do whatever we want with the land, we can't do whatever we want. We have to follow God's laws. God's the sovereign. That's why we pay God taxes. That's the truma that we give to God. Usually you pay taxes. Who do you pay taxes to? You pay taxes to the sovereign power. So the truma, our taxes that we pay to God, it goes to God, then God gives it to the Kohanim. But the idea that the reason why you're only chayv and trumot, only once we have conquest of land, maybe we'll see that later on in our course, that might relate to this idea that that we're our sovereign, but we want to show God that God's sovereign. So even though temporarily or sort of our rights, we're like a vassal king on our own land, where the sovereign, the king, is going to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's giving us the right or mandate to rule ourselves on the land, but in contrast to God, we have to feel like Ger V'Toshavim. So the word Ger V'Toshav in Sefer Bereshit, I think, is going to set up a deeper understanding of our possession of the land of Israel, the laws of Shemitah. And then again, what that follow with, because of that, if someone is poor in the land, don't take advantage of the fact and buy. What happens? Let me end with this. Our time's up. What tends to happen in normal societies is that you buy up a lot of land, and that's what happened in feudal Europe. Who became the nobles? People who were able to buy up a lot of land. People who were poor, they bought the land from them. They couldn't pay their bills. The nobles owned the land, and then you have serfs and nobles, and you can never get out of it. And people, either you're born into nobility, or you're a serf, or you're nobody. And it becomes that way forever. God wants to set up a situation where when someone falls apart financially, we have to help them out. And there's always the security of the Yovel cycle where you give back to your land every 50 years. But the idea in land ownership, we want to make sure that land ownership is not controlled by a small group of people. We want to make sure that there's equality, and we don't want to take advantage of people who fall into financial stress, whether we have to go out our way to help them up. That's called the Goel, who comes and saves them from their trouble. So again, owning land is a tool in how we sanctify God, and not the goal of becoming rich and wealthy. So that was an idea also that we see from here. And so that's, again, let me summarize. I simply want to show you in Bereshit, Ger is only mentioned twice, but the second mention by Avram, Ger V'Toshav, I think, is setting the stage for understanding how we relate to ourselves when we are sovereign in the land. And then the need, the first time, that to become God's nation, to appreciate what it means to be suffering. And therefore, if one of the goals of God choosing a nation is being a model nation, to be this Avamon Goyim, a mentor nation for other nations to learn from, then our experience to become that nation of going through suffering and know what it feels like to suffer, that has to be ingrained in our national consciousness and our awareness. And that has to almost typify us as a nation, because we need to be known as a nation that goes out of its way to care for the people who are downtrodden. And when people are in financial stress, it's our job to help them, not to take advantage of the financial stress and become wealthy because of their difficult situation. The opposite. We use our wealth to help those in need. And in most countries, what happens is that when people are in stress, the wealthy take advantage, and that's how you get strong. That's how you build up your wealth. And we need to have a country where we need to be wealthy, but we use our wealth to distribute it to help others. We become trustees with our wealth, and we'll see that as we go through the different books, we'll see that theme being repeated almost in every single book, especially in relation to the stranger.
Rabbi, then how do you deal with Yosef basically selling all of Egypt except for the priestly class into permanent serfdom just because of the famine?
So two things. Was that Yosef's idea or was that Paro's idea?
Can't tell from the text, at least I don't think.
So when we study that, you'll see that Yosef's idea was to store and that's his dream. His dream was to store the wealth of Egypt. You can have 7 years of prosperity. What happened? Who ate the lean cows, ate the fat cows? Remember that? Actually, it belongs with Sefer Bereshit, so we can talk about it. Remember in his dream, the lean cows eat the fat cows. What did Yosef understand? The fat cows, the 7 years of plenty, are going to provide us with wealth to survive the 7 years of famine. So what were they supposed to do? They were supposed to, Egypt was supposed to store, or the people were supposed to store their grain during the 7 years of plenty. And that's how they were going to survive the 7 years of famine. But the wealth belonged to the people, not to Pharaoh. So they stored it up for the people, but the Pharaoh should have been a trustee on behalf of the people. Instead, Egypt and the government of Egypt took Yosef's advice and they used it to buy up all the land of Egypt to become almost a dictatorship. And they bought all the land. And now it could be, that's why the people hated, who's the Melech Hadash? There's a new dynasty in Egypt. There was a rebellion in Egypt because the people didn't like the fact that all the land was bought up. And that new Pharaoh, who was appointed after the rebellion, when the new times against the Pharaoh who bought up all the land, it's not surprising they start hating the Jews, blaming the Jews for what happened. Now, it could be, was it Yosef's idea to buy up the land, or that was Pharaoh's taking advantage of Yosef's advice? That you can argue when you read the story. Yosef's advice was to use the produce, and the government of Egypt should have been a trustee on behalf of the people and distributed to the people afterwards. Instead, the government used Yosef's advice to buy up all the land. Now, was that Yosef's idea, or was that or they were taking advantage of Yosef's idea? They used his prediction and they took advantage of it. Either way, it could very well be that might have been the natural reason for the oppression, and why the oppression was like that. Was that a mistake what Yosef did? Did Pharaoh take advantage of him? That's a discussion when you study Sefer Bereshit. But there's no doubt in my opinion that the what Egypt did with the wealth and buying up all the land, I think that led later to the hatred of the Jews and leading to the oppression later on.
Rabbi, why did Yosef not protest against it?
Why didn't he? Again, it's hard to judge whether he could or couldn't.
But that really is a huge question.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I'd rather not judge. I don't want to judge our forefathers for good or for bad. I'll leave that to the Parshanim sometimes. But we can definitely learn. There's no doubt that we're supposed to learn. If they did make mistakes, we're supposed to learn from their mistakes. So our job is not to sit and judge our forefathers, but rather, if we see something in the text that seems to be negative type of behavior, we're supposed to learn from that how to fix it, not to repeat that mistake.
From the pshat, it looks like it's Yosef suggesting.
Yeah. So it could be it was a mistake by Yosef. It could be it was his idea, or it could be he should have protested. But did he have the ability to protest? We don't know.
No. Good questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, and let me check the chat real fast. Any more questions? Oh, we do have questions. Here we go. Okay, maybe it's because you made Sarah a stranger in Pharaoh's house. That's another possibility about why, and midrashically, why was Avram punished because he sort of took advantage of Sarah's position and made himself wealthy because of that. That's a good question. Did Avram do the right thing telling Sarah to say that she was his sister had he told the truth, maybe he would have been killed, and so what would have gained. But he definitely meant well. But he wasn't. It turned out in his advantage. I don't think you can prove that he did something wrong. But again, but I don't think in Pshat that's the reason for the need to go into slavery in Egypt. The connection between the Karat Brit for sure. What Asher is mentioning, the word for entering a covenant is the same word, the same verb that's used being cut off for the covenant. The Chrot is to be cut off from a Brit, Karat, or when you make the Brit in the first place, you take two parts. The Karat means to be cut off, but because the ceremony of entering a Brit was cutting animals in half and walking between them, therefore the verb for entering a covenant becomes it's cut off because you're cutting. Got it? So the Chrot Brit is because when you made a Brit in ancient times, you cut animals in half and walked in between them. That's, you know, Josh Berman's got a book on that stuff about ancient, covenants in ancient, but you see it in Yirmiyahu as well, that people made that covenant when they said they're going to free their slaves. That was a custom of how you made a Brit. So because you cut animals to make a Brit, therefore the verb for convening a Brit becomes karet. But then when you're cut off from the Brit, it's beautiful that we use the same word. But remember, it's always you're cut off from your people. So that was that side. That was a good point Asher's making. I said, Ager is an outsider. Yeah, that's a good question. Ager, I think it's cool. Not an outsider. Ger hagar itchem. You know, is vayagor, remember, what did Im Lavan garti? You're living there, but you're dwelling somewhere, but you're right. I hear your point. Could be an outsider. It's an outsider again from a covenantal community as opposed to a thing. I just think the whole point of a ger and a zrach later on is you're not an outsider. We want to include you. Why call him a ger? We'll see that over and over again when we get next week. We see keger kezrach. We'll get to the definition. When we get to Korban Pesach next week.
I think Ger has a meaning in part as a sojourner and also as a migrant, somebody passing through.
Okay, but that's a question. Are we assuming that the Ger is going to stay with us forever? Or is the Ger someone transient and temporarily with us? Do we want to treat the Ger nicely as a stranger because he's going to go home one day and he'll talk about his great experience visiting Israel? If he was living here for 2-3 years, we want him to go home and tell the people I was in this country and how great they treated me. Is it a PR type of thing? Or do we want him to convert one day? I think all the possibilities are fine. You're nice. You have to be nice because it's the right thing to be nice. Now, it'll have its fringe benefits because they'll say nice things about you. But we don't want to treat, let's say we're helping the Ukrainians, the Ukrainian refugees. We don't do it so we look good in the eyes of the nation. We do it because it's the right thing to do. Now, it's true, once it's the right thing to do, and nations see it, they'll maybe, view us in a nicer manner. But you don't do it only so that people, you don't do it just for PR, you do it because it's the right thing to do. One last question, and perhaps Abraham and Israel should be classified at best as gerim, since the Balfour explicitly said Jews should have political rights. Okay, that's a... Oh, the Aravim, I say, okay. So that's a good question. I don't want to get into politics about what's the status of non-Jews in Israel or a thing. But what has to do with the Arab population, that's a whole different question of who is... There's a difference between we're here and strangers come into our land. What happens when two people are living in the same land? That's the Palestinian problem is a different one. Because there's two now. Who came first and who was here first? That's different narratives. That gets but there's a big difference between a country exists, and then other people, a small group of people come temporarily, as opposed to two different nations living in the same land. I think it's much more complicated. Welcome to the Middle East.
I have a question. Yeah. If you. If you look at the word "get" and take it in the context of the two examples in Breshit,
yeah,
it so if the person, so first God tells us that we gotta go back, go down to Mitzrayim because we have to know what it's like to be again, and I'm totally okay with that. But then he comes and says, I'm again every destroyer of two. So unless you say that the purchase of the land doesn't end the status of Geirut, whatever that means, the question arises, why do I have to learn to be a Geirut? Why do I have to go to Egypt to be a Geirut if I'm already a Geirut in Israel?
Oh, okay. So again, we'll deal with that. I have to finish. I have to leave in 2-3 minutes. I have something at 7:30. But in general, it's called living in a dialectic where you need to be sovereign, but you feel that you're not sovereign. Now, the story of Egypt is a collective experience that we talk about all the time. And studying the story and studying, you know, our slavery, that's why at the Seder, we have to feel like we went through the experience. So if we can identify with the experience, we don't have to suffer again. If we can live a life, if we can apply its message in our day-to-day life and be kind to the stranger and live a life of its message, we don't need to go through that suffering again. But if we don't keep that message, Chumash says, we'll see in Devarim, I'll send you back to Egypt and to be sold into slavery there. Remember, that's the end of the Tochacha, where you didn't learn, you could do it the easy way by having a Seder and having a transformative experience of how to behave. If you don't internalize the message, God warns you, I'll throw you out. Now, the main point is that there's a need to feel like a stranger because you're sovereign. You follow? Because you own the land, and because owning land and being sovereign leads to haughtiness and taking advantage of people who don't own. So God wants us to live in this dialectic. On the one hand, we're sovereign in our land. At the same time, we shouldn't feel it's a gift that God gave us to use it properly. So we become a trustee in our land. And not sovereign, it doesn't belong to us. And that dialectic, I think, is key in the Jewish experience of everything in Olam Hazeh, where any wealth we have to appreciate it and use it properly, but we have to feel like trustees and not just as owners. And we have to finish here, so we'll stop here today.
Thank you.
Next week, we're going to go into Sefer Shmot. We'll see Korban Pesach. We'll see Parshat Mishpatim. We'll see the loss of Chametz. And we'll see where the few times that the Ger is mentioned, but those would be critical. We'll use that to define the Jewish Ger and the non-Jewish Ger. Everyone have a good week, and Yiras Hashem, we'll see you next week.